headlines. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jail start a mass hunger strike after a fellow inmate dies of medical negligence. The Yemeni army now in control of more areas in Ma'arib, fighting its way toward the center of the flashpoint province held by Saudi-backed militants. Plus protest scuffles and tear gas in Sudan as opponents of a military coup turn out again a day after a deadly security response. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Palestinian inmate is dead after suffering years of systematic medical negligence in an Israeli jail. Sami Amour, 39, was from the Gaza Strip. He was detained in 2008 and handed a 19-year jail term. He was denied family visits all throughout his time in prison. The Palestinian Prisoners Society says he suffered from a congenital heart disease. It says that his health worsened over time due to Israel's deliberate medical negligence and harsh jail conditions. He was transferred several days ago to a hospital where he underwent two surgeries but did not survive. The group is now holding the Tel Aviv regime responsible for Amour's death. It's inviting legal and human rights groups to try to seek the release of all ailing Palestinian inmates as soon as possible. Palestinians locked up in all Israeli jails have started a group hunger strike in mourning for Amour and in protest at his death. Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil. She told us more about the circumstances that finally led to Sami Amour's death.
Sami Amour from the Gaza Strip, from the city of Deir al-Balah. He was arrested by the Israeli forces in 2008. Several days ago, he was transferred by the Israeli prison authorities from the jail of Nafha to Asqalan jail, and then he was transferred to the Israeli hospital of Soroka in Deir al-Sabra, and he underwent two surgeries. However, he passed away. The main reason is not the surgeries, of course. As you have mentioned, he was very sick. His death is because of medical negligence, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society and the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners and Ex-Prisoners. They say that Al-Amour suffered from congenital heart problems and being held in difficult detention conditions, of course, would be increased and worsen his situation. He was not taken for regular checks because of the Israeli prison had been claiming it's because of the spread of COVID-19. However, the Israeli prison authorities do not ensure any medical treatment or any treatment or any kind of checkups for the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. And Hamoud is not the first Palestinian prisoner to pass away inside jail.
The identity of the senior Israeli spy involved in cyber attacks on Iran is now out in the open following the latest revelations by an Iranian news agency. Fars News Agency has released the personal information of the senior Israeli officer identified as Ohad Zaidenberg. The agency has also published photos from a confidential conference where Zaidenberg recently delivered a speech on Iran's security and military institutions. According to Fars, the officer is one of the pillars of Israel's cybersecurity. He's constantly monitoring the developments in Iran and engineering schemes to conduct acts of sabotage and trigger unrest in the country. Israel is behind several cyber attacks that have targeted Iran's strategic infrastructure, including nuclear facilities, in the past. Saudi Arabia carrying out massive aerial bombardments of neighboring Yemen, targeting multiple locations across several provinces there. The Saudi military hit positions in the provinces of Sana'a, Dhamar, Sa'ada, and Al-Jawf. So far, we have no word on possible damage or casualties. Riyadh says it launched the aerial campaign after intercepting a drone that attempted to attack the Abha International Airport. That's an airport that Saudi jets often use to launch airstrikes on residential areas in Yemen. Also developing news out of Ma'arib. That's a flashpoint province which Yemeni forces have for a while been trying to liberate from militants supported by Saudi Arabia. Yemeni troops who are backed by fighters from popular committees are now in control of several new strategic regions in that province and advancing toward the center. So far, 12 out of 14 cities in Ma'arib have been liberated. And we've spoken to our correspondent in Yemen, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, to get more about the latest developments inside Yemen. Let's take a listen.
The Saudi regime is continuing to bomb the civilians, to bomb the residential areas. They are only justifying the bombardments by saying that they are attacking military targets. They are not military targets. These attacks will only push the Yemeni army to respond to the attacks, to continue to attack with the drones or the ballistic missiles, to attack the Saudi camps, to attack the Saudi airports that are being used for military purposes, such as Abha. They said, the Saudi media said that the Yemeni army was attempting yesterday to attack Abha airport. The Yemeni army said earlier that this airport is being used for military purposes, is being used for bombing the Yemeni people. So it is the right, the legitimate right for the Yemeni army to respond to these attacks and to bomb whether Abha airport or other military targets inside the kingdom. The Yemeni army is continuing its attack toward Marib to liberate the city. I believe that the Saudi regime has come to realize that they have not achieved anything since the beginning of the war, so they know that the Yemeni army will continue its operations and they will lose at the end of the war.
The United Nations says the summary executions of 10 Yemeni prisoners by Saudi mercenaries was wrong, and the perpetrators must be brought to justice.
We condemn the summary execution of 10 individuals belonging to local security forces that took place in Hodeidah Governorate on 13th November. These amount to serious violations of international humanitarian and international human rights law, which must be promptly and thoroughly investigated and perpetrators brought to justice.
Dujarric wants all sides to fully adhere to international humanitarian and human rights laws under all circumstances. Yemen's National Salvation Government has also weighed in on the executions, describing the move as a war crime and a blatant violation of international humanitarian law. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia waged a war against Yemen in 2015 following the ouster of then-president Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions more displaced since then. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. This segment of the program, the situation remains volatile in Sudan, with anti-coup protesters and police facing off again in Khartoum after a day of bloody scuffles. Just hours ago, security forces fired tear gas to push back protesters from barricades. Large numbers of police are now deployed in the north of the capital, where crowds kept up their protests throughout the night. The deputies' crackdown since the military took over happened on Wednesday. At least 15 protesters were killed. The military seized power late last month and arrested dozens of government officials, including the prime minister. Scores of protesters have been killed and hundreds of others injured since then. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Sudan affairs expert Saeed Shahabi, who's joining us from London. And also we have Jonathan Ofeansa, publisher at the Africa Briefing, joining us from the British capital, London, as well. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Shahabi in London. Sir, how do you view the recent unrest in Sudan, and where is it headed at this point in time?
Thank you very much. It is very, very worrying to see the army deployed and using live ammunition to kill protesters. Of course, the people of Sudan will not accept to be governed by Burhan, by President Burhan, who has established relations and normalized relations with Israel. They do not like to see a military take over to undo everything that they have achieved over the past 20, 30 years. And I think also there is the tendency among the Sudanese not to really accept either dictatorship or normalization with Israel. We should understand that Khartoum was the place where what was known as the three no's, no to recognition, no to negotiation, no to submission to Israel. That was the conference or the summit that was held after the 1967 war in Khartoum. And these were the three no's that came out of that conference, of that summit, in which Gamal Abdel Nasser at the time was present. Now, Sudanese cannot be subjugated with force. It is a large country. It is the gateway to Africa, and this is why the Emirates have put a lot of pressure on Sudan to normalize relations with Israel, and this is why the Israelis want to have this gate to northern Africa, the Arab part of Africa, and also to the black part of Africa. So unfortunately, this Mr. Burhan has staged and waged his coup in the same way as the president of Tunisia also, Saeed Qais Saeed, also staged his coup against the government. So it is a very complicated issue, but it is a matter of conflict between the pro-democracy activism and those dictatorships supported by the counter-revolution forces, including Israel.
Mr. Ofayansa, give us your thoughts on the issue as well, and whether you agree with the comments made by our guest in London. Where is this headed at this point, and how alarming is the situation right now in Sudan?
Absolutely agree with the other guest. Yeah, it is the Sudanese people, I mean civilian population, are really determined. You know, they are hell bent on making sure that this junta does not stay in power. I mean, even despite the cuts, you know, in internet and phone services being disconnected, you know, they still manage to galvanize, you know, and organize, you know, and hold these protests. I mean, we should recall that it was likely to due to civil resistance in Sudan that led to the overthrow of the former president, the former president al-Bashir. So in the same vein, the Sudanese people are also, at this time, will do all that they can, you know, to make sure that this regime, you know, goes back to dialogue with the outside civilian administration, right, and resort to the status quo.
Mr. Ofayansa, I'm going to stay with you for this question. Let's looking at what's taking place right now in Sudan in the broader picture. Who benefits actually from this instability in Sudan?
See, what you say, who benefits? I mean, within the country or externally? If it's within the country, nobody does, okay? Because number one, the U.S. has already frozen $700 million in aid to Sudan. The World Bank and the IMF are doing so. And France, which was due to reschedule or cancel Sudan's debt to the country, is also reconsidering the idea. So if anything, you know, with all these sanctions coming on, the Sudanese people, civil society, are the ones that are going to suffer. And the longer, you know, the more they suffer, the harder will be their resolve to make sure that this junta does not succeed, right, and goes back to dialogue and restore to the status quo.
Mr. Shabi, the same question to you as well.
Well, definitely the Sudanese will not benefit from the military junta. They don't. No civilized society would like to be ruled by military junta. This is what it was rejected in Algeria when they took over after the 1992 elections. And they are now being rejected in Egypt when they staged a coup against the elected government. And wherever they rule, they cannot be accepted as a legitimate government. So the Sudanese will not benefit. The only beneficiary is Israel, which is trying to make Sudan way to Africa. Unfortunately, the alliance that is taking place now, that's happening between the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and Israel, the counter-revolution forces, are pushing the Arab world into those conflicts, internal conflicts, rather than bringing them together in order to support the Palestinian cause. They want to put aside and finish and end and remove the Palestinian cause from the Arab agenda, and try to install these generals and military men and military people in order to subjugate the people. And I believe that this could be the beginning of another Arab Spring against the American-supported regimes that have no intention of upholding democracy or respecting human rights of the people.
So, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. Sudan Affairs expert Saeed Chaabi joining us from London, also speaking to us from the British Capital Publisher at Africa Briefing. Jonathan Ofeansa, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us here on News Review. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this segment of the program, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on. Welcome back. Your own special envoy to Afghanistan is sat for separate talks with the Taliban officials on ways to expand mutual ties between the two neighboring countries in various areas. Ranatullah Baghwan has more in this report.
On the last day of his stay in the Afghan capital, Kabul, your own special envoy to Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qomi, held separate meetings with a number of the Taliban officials on mutual ties. Acting ministers of agriculture, economy, refugees affairs, information and culture, commerce and industry, and tribal and borders affairs were among the officials who held talks with the Iranian envoy. During the talks, both sides announced their readiness for expansion of ties in different areas and discussed ways for further cooperation. Qomi arrived in the Afghan capital, Kabul, on Monday at the head of a delegation for talks with the new government in the neighboring Afghanistan. Iran has called for formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan representing all Afghans. It has also called for an end to violence in the country. Iran says attaches significant importance to the security and welfare of Afghanistan, adding a stable Afghanistan serves not only the interests of the region, but that of the whole world. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner, who's a freelance film critic who writes for Godzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centers on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American-Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Sung founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And and this film shows the Sun family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of the Federal Savings Bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you were going to pick on a bank, family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, it's about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese. When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He was lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute. Maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, they're a whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang
herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old. He's been up since 5:30 a.m. and he has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean, so I'm always running around.
Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest, one of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. In this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective of it, that sort of family oriented perspective of it is very interesting. I've really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story, like you care deeply about the family and get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself. And I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I certainly think he was trying to. I mean, you have you have the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually it's the reality is it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, you know, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad to pick on you. You're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially as a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Abacus Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. And that is, you know, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this. They're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have our day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Song family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the, I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the court case begins and before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in, you get a lot of the, you're obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back, and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest.
And Clive, would you agree? What did you make of the Song's family challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually bring them and ship them into pleading guilty, and they failed.
I mean, absolutely, there is a clip where Tom Sung, basically, he's offered a plea deal, and then they just says, no, I'm not going to take that plea deal. It's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, they don't take the deal, exactly. And, I mean, as you say, it cost them $10 million, so another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
And Clive, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Versus, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposedly Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. what was happening in the subprime crisis is that people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, mm-hmm. unlike Abacus Bank, which had really well-documented loans. Mm-hmm. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who
yes,
was giving out
there is
bad
obviously
loans.
A cultural element to this case, which is debt is a construct, is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring. They were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
I'm a former prosecutor. I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey, and particularly his position within the sort of small town community, what feels like a small town community, and helping people with small businesses. And he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing a run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, trust me, you know me, I'm here, your money's safe, and it worked. And
it was an
incredible
moment.
Scene, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch. As Matthew said, they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cave and plead for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight. And I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such, as demonizing a community, but clearly it had that effect. And it's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. But that has completely gone with these mega banks, so there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the VA, correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, you know, Russian bankers or, what, you know, he sort of lists another, like, other ethnic groups, yeah, but doesn't, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers, and that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, you know, like an hour and a half each way. So he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea, anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still does. She hates the city, you know. She's like me. We both have headaches. And at home, when we don't want them to understand, we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave me two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder, if any other bank CEOs are this caring. And Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. The mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion, and she sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you get a
real feel. But then it highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins, and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney. Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. They all sit on the Bank of International Settlements Board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008. Because they control.
And we saw this in our
country
as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control the nation's money supply, and I care not about its laws. Simply money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching the documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this, what it happens to be some family, is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no, but you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background. And certainly, like I said, the press conference that Cyrus, VA Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of ebullient statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect, well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
Well, certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
A little spoiler, but yes.
Yes, a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. Yeah, it makes you angry a little bit and it's, you know, it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's, you know, all for the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive, would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. And so, you know, that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. And we've come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. We looked at the economic vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen and how he wanted to equalize between people, and this topic is quite long, so we will leave it at that. When we look at the politics of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and when he looks at politics itself, and especially when it comes to dealing with people and the governing body, and also, like we said before, there is 25 years that preceded Amir al-Mu'mineen that was like a cancer in the body of Islam, that the gap between people and the government and those who led, it was too big to reconcile, to the extent that during the life of the third Khalifa, as historians tell us, that the Muslims themselves, they surrounded his house for 3 days. They even denied him water, that Amir al-Mu'mineen had to bring him water himself, and at the end they managed to assassinate him. And one of the reasons was because he created such a gap between him and the people when it comes to economy and when it comes to politics. So he had 25 years of a huge gap that he had to fill in terms of trying to establish justice in terms of politics. So he says, Jamal al-siyasati al-adl, what beautifies politics is justice. That's how justice should be. When it comes to politics, it has to be based on justice. Politics today, and even back in the day, was based on, it's an illusion of trying to give people their right, but in fact was based on oppression and taking the rights of others. It's based on lies. Politicians now, the majority of them are just liars. They lie to people with fancy words and they take their rights. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says, the beauty of politics is justice. It needs to have justice. Then when he used to send his governors to other cities, he used to say to them, إِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ فَعْدُلُوا. If you lead, if you're in a position of power, then you have to be just. You have to be fair. So it's not a matter of you having power. As we say, with power comes a great responsibility. You need to treat people with justice. And then he says, أَفْضَلُ عِبَادُ اللَّهِ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ إِمَامٌ عَدِلٌ. The best people in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is an imam, a leader that is just. And leader, when we say imam, what I mean in the infallible imams, but anyone who leads in Arabic is referred to as an imam. He says anyone who leads and he deals with people based on justice, so his politics is based on justice, he says he is the best of the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because being in a special position itself, it's very hard. It's not an easy position to be in, and you don't get sucked in by the power of it. Because with such power, when a person is in position, temptations are high. He sees himself better than people. There's money under him. There's people under him. And usually that if a person is not controlling himself and his desires, usually that overtakes him. And we can see that in our daily life today. We can see the politicians and those who are in power, and we can see how much power it drives them to madness. And we can see it with the tyrants of our times as well. Power drives them to be mad. And Amir al-Mu'mineen says, well, keep in mind, if you want to be the best amongst Allah, you have to be just, which is hard to do. But if you do it, and if you manage to do it, then be sure that you are the best in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let us take a break and then we continue inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at politics from the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Salamullah alayhi. And again, he is trying to talk to us about his methods of dealing with people when it came to him being in power and treating those who are under his government. So we said he heavily invested in the concept of justice, trying to be just when it comes to terms, when it comes in terms of politics. He says, وَإِنَّ زَمَنَ الْعَادِلِ خَيْرُ الْأَزْمَنَةِ وَزَمَنَ الْجَارِ شَرُّ الْأَزْمَنَةِ. Even the times of good rulers, fair and just rulers, is the best of times. Because when a ruler is fair and just to his servants and to his people, to his citizens, then he would want to make sure that all of them are okay, all of them are good, all of them are happy, all of them are, at least they have food, they have sustenance, they have all the things they need. And he says the worst of times are the times of oppressive rulers. When there's an oppressive ruler, the whole place, the whole society starts to suffer, as we can see in our modern day. Amir al-Mu'mineen, even he himself, he applied that to the teeth, that during his time, it was said that no one went to bed hungry, that he used to go around trying to seek people, poor people, and sometimes when he doesn't find anyone, he sits to himself and he wonders, there might be a person somewhere in Yemen or in another part of the world that he can't remember the last time he was full. To that extent. So he worked heavily and he invested heavily in himself, trying to provide people with all their basic needs, which he did so himself. And then he says, إِيَّاكَ وَالْجَوْرُ فَإِنَّ الْجَارَ لَا يَشْمُ رَائِحَةَ الْجَنَّةِ. And when he advised his governors and those who are in power, he says, I warn you, do not oppress people, for oppression, for those who oppress people, will not smell the fragrance of heaven. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, if a ruler or a leader or whoever is in position takes the rights of other people, then obviously he's outcasted from the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It doesn't matter if he's a Muslim or not. And like we said, if we look at the 25 years that preceded Amir al-Mu'mineen, we can see such unfairness happened. And even after him, things just went downhill from there. Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas, when they came to power, they turned the Muslim world into slavery. To the extent Yazid, when he invaded Medina in year 62 or 63 Hijri, he took an oath from people that they are his absolute servants. They're not human beings anymore. They're not free. They were his absolute servants that he can do with them any way he likes. And you can see, compare that to the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, where he used to walk in the market. Some people don't even know who he is. And sometimes some people might bump into him and they would call him bad names and he would just let it go. And he was the governor. That did not work with Bani Umayyah very well or Bani Abbas very well. Or even those who were before Amir al-Mu'mineen, they looked at themselves as kings, and power to them was a tool to enslave people, to enslave the Muslims, not to free them. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen says, no, there's absolutely no difference. If you're in power, your first job is to make sure that you establish justice and deal with people with just fairness and equality, and do not differentiate yourself from them. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.